Hi there, folks. Welcome to a Squiggly podcast special. It's been a couple of years, but here's another British Animation Awards look back celebration. Celebration of the celebration? I don't know. this is the problem with doing it every 2 years. You get out of practice and you don't know how the hell to introduce the damn thing. I'm Ben Mitchell, joined by Steve Henderson and Laura Beth Cowley. How are you both doing?
Good, good, thank you.
Yeah, good.
I'm very good as well, yeah. Doing incredibly well here. We're looking forward to looking back on looking back, as you say, to the British Animation Awards, that biannual celebration of the very best of British animation. It's been a month. We've been travelling around doing loads of other festivals and things like that, Ben, so we've barely had a chance to catch up, have we? Apart from when we were at the awards. But the good news is it's been a month and our hangovers are finally clear. So, we had a good night. We celebrated British animation.
Well, it was, I think, an improvement over the last edition. Not to say that the last edition wasn't run well or that the outcomes weren't good. It was just that little bit near the old COVID knuckle, and the world wasn't quite normal yet. But, you know, technically it was fine to do, but there was just this kind of residual tension from having not been out among very large groups of people in a very densely populated space. But also a kind of like real appetite to see people again. And there were people there that I really wanted to see. And, you know, some of them I had never actually met. I just met them over Zoom because it had been, you know, literally years. But there's this kind of, yeah, this ambivalent energy of the like, oh my God, hey, it's good to see you. Don't f***ing touch me. whereas that wasn't really there, for this year's edition. Everyone was just happy to kind of, yeah, have a bit of a kiss and a cuddle and
Lick each other's faces. Maybe. It was great.
Make it sound like a bar orgy.
Just like the old days.
I think we're just numb now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's almost like I'm completely disassociated from that time. It's like it never happened.
Mm.
Well, I think that'll be where we do eventually sort of get. I think we're seeing, you know, the last couple of maths and the last calf, you know. It's been 2 years since that, pretty much. We were all in a much better place, I think, when they did that. And that wasn't that long after the bars.
Mm.
Doing things like, you know, the kind of year-round events and the Bristol Animation meetups. I did have one person, like, text me saying, Bam gave me COVID.
Hmm?
And I said, well, the event doesn't give you COVID. It's the decision to go out in public. You know, it's our autonomy is what gives us COVID now that we've had the injection.
Quote for the event.
Yeah, that's our endorsement quote.
Yeah. Bam gave me COVID and at no extra cost.
But yeah, no, the bars were great. It was, fantastic to see people and generally pretty happy with the results. You have a specially recorded post-bar roundtable.
Mm-hmm.
That we'll get to in a sec. I guess, shall we have a little rattling off of who won? The stars of the night?
Yeah, the darlings of British animation. The big winners obviously being Lucasfilms for Kensuke's Kingdom, really. It won three categories, didn't it? It won the Best Feature, the Writers' Award, and Best Original Music. Have you seen Kensuke's Kingdom?
No, we're going to check it out at CAF.
Mm.
Wanted to wait for it to be in a cinema when I had time, and I just haven't really had the time. But no, CAF have taken, like, fully booked off the whole period of the festival, and we're going to be there doing stuff. So, looking forward to checking that out. Everyone seems pretty enthusiastic about it.
It's a great flick. It really is. You're in for a treat, let's put it that way. And it's been around for a good long while, and thankfully I think a trailer's been released recently. So, you know, it could be working its way to the old mainstream cinemas so everyone can see it. At least I hope so, because it did big numbers in France as well when it was released in France. So plenty of people like it on the continent. So let's get it released in the UK and let people enjoy the film over here more as well, because so far it's only been screened at festivals. We screened it at MAF and it's screened elsewhere. But yeah, so everyone heading to Cardiff, make sure that's on your list as well.
And Lupus also got itself a win in Best Long Form.
Mm-hmm.
A different project, one that we talked about on the last episode of the main Squiggly Animation podcast, Mog's Christmas.
Yeah, that was interesting, so wasn't it?
Check out that interview.
It was co-won, wasn't it? Or shared the honours, or... Well, it wasn't quite sharing. They got a prize each, but A Bear Named Wojtek, Ian Gardner's short film, long short film, I suppose, is the other way of describing it. Half-hour retelling of the tale of Wojtek, a bear which ended up being a soldier, sort of see it to believe it story, but also a tale of immigration, acceptance, and yeah, full of all that lovely hand-drawn pencil animation magic. Well, hand-drawn magic at least. A Mog's Christmas is much the same in terms of that kind of hand illustrated magic. Beautiful piece of work.
And on to Best Short Film. Someone else we recently had on the site, Elizabeth Hobbs's new film, or latest film, The Debutante. And that's probably my favorite film, really, of the bunch, personally.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely just sort of, it's definitely my favorite film of hers. And it's one of the films that has really kind of been on the leaderboard for me the last year or so.
Mm.
I think it's a perfect kind of storm of the type of work that she does, the type of visual storytelling that she has this natural gift for. She's so incredibly prolific as a filmmaker. And the thing that comes with being a prolific filmmaker, you know, it's the same with people like Bill Plimpton, is not everything. If you like one strand of their films, you're not necessarily going to engage as much with all of it, because they like to do new things, and they, you know, experiment a lot, and they, you know, find their ultimate voice as a filmmaker. And I think that The Debutante, for me, really kind of represents all of the aspects of Elizabeth's films that I've loved the most, in a story that's a bit more kind of cohesive. It has a kind of dialogue driven narration to it. It's weird. Mm. Like, it's a very odd story. It's, you know, you have to suspend a great deal of disbelief. but it's the perfect kind of film to do that with, because yeah, she does such a great job of carrying that world over. And you talked to her recently about that, didn't you, Laura?
Yeah, it was it's always nice to talk to Lizzie. I've known Lizzie for a fair few years. She was one of my tutors when I studied animation in my undergrad, so literally learnt from her. But yeah, I think it helps with Lizzie's work with this particular film, because it's quite figurative, which her work isn't normally. It's a lot more abstracted. There's normally characters within it, but this is a film that you made use, I believe, of rotoscoping, but in a very loose way. And so I think that helps keep the story a little bit more structurally, structurally like understandable, which maybe is why it's perhaps had one of the better runs of some of her other films, because it's a little bit more easier to digest.
When I think about I'm Okay, I think was the name of the film, that one, it's a great film, but it took me a couple of watches to I think fully kind of appreciate it. And I think with this film, it does kind of, I think the dialogue and the telling of the story, it kind of holds your hand through it a bit more. Whereas, some of her other films, it's perhaps a bit more open to interpretation, or it's a lot more kind of wildly sort of loose and experimentation.
Mm.
But it isn't to say that the visuals in this film are restrained at all. They're really quite off the wall and just like very, very fun to watch.
Yeah. So. Yeah. You wouldn't be able to pick a single frame out and go associate it instantly with the film. There was a moment when you first get into animation and you go to film festivals and you think you know everything, you're at university and you're watching short films and you're like, yeah, don't talk to me. I know Nick Park is, you know, I've heard of him. I know his name. I know everything about animation. And I remember watching, do you know animation? There are three animation styles. There's 2D, which is Disney. There's stop motion, which is Morph. And then there is Toy Story. Those are the three animation styles, everybody. There's nothing else.
All bases covered.
All bases covered. I wasn't quite that bad. At least I hope I wasn't. And then I saw the old, very old man, which was just... seeing it on the big screen, I think it was at Bradford Animation Festival in 2006 or 7 or something like that. And it just blew me away. I was like, how was this done? Like, what am I watching? What am I looking at? Is that a cell? Yeah. Is that a ceramic? What is that? And is it ink? Is it water? Is it what am I looking at? How have they made it move? Is it and just indulging in that kind of, you know, the technique is just fantastic. So yeah, well deserved for debutante as well, which, as you say, it does kind of flow in and out of. Not quite rotoscope, but a kind of, there's a hint every now and then of which adds that structure to it, which is such a mesmerizing thing to watch, as are all of her films. So yeah, very, very well deserved.
So you can check out the interview with Elizabeth on the Squiggly Interviews section.
Mm-hmm.
Good stuff. Next up, best voice performance, I believe, went to the amazing Maurice.
Probably the most expensive voice performance, if you look at the list of Hugh Laurie, Emilia Clarke, David Thewlis, Himesh Patel, Gemma Arterton, Hugh Bonneville, David Tennant. You know, it's a bit...
Which one of them won the award?
I don't know.
Or did they all win the...
I think the producer, Andrew, just ran off with it under his arm. So, yeah, I'll go up in his office.
Oh, it's a shame it didn't go to, like, David Thewlis specifically. It would have been fun if the shame wizard had been at the bus. Yeah. I've just been cornering him, asking him questions about Fargo.
Yeah. Yeah, we also had the Great British Bake Off winning for promotional trailer for the best animation in a commercial, which we'll be talking to the director presently. Best Music Video Award was Late Nights, directed by Golden Wolf. I'm just reading the list now. Sorry, it sounds really boring.
Well, it's got to be done, Steve.
It certainly has, yeah.
At this point, we've committed to it, so we can't leave anyone out. Best Children's Preschool Series and Best Design went to Odo. Fantastic stuff. That was by 16 South. Best Children's Series went to Rubbish World of Dave Spud. Against some hot competition...
Mm-hmm.
But fair play to him. And
he seemed really pleased to have won.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can imagine that. Yeah.
I think they were nominated for quite a lot of things, and I think it might have been that. Like, they were sort of in almost every category. And then it was like, yeah, they finally did it.
Well, the big one for that was poor Will Anderson was at the front.
Yeah.
And the presenter...
Henning Venn.
Yeah, it became this recurring joke that no one at the front had won a fucking thing. And
why did they sit you here?
Yeah. And eventually, finally, like, I think it was the last award they gave out. Because he was there with a cat called Dom, but also for Shackle. And didn't that ultimately win...
That won an audience award.
Yeah. So thankfully, you know, which he was able to kind of get.
Everyone was very happy about that. Like, hey, front row people.
Yeah.
They maybe should do that next time, is maybe put everyone who's nominated for award in the front two or three rows.
Like, you'd think they'd have worked that out. Yeah. Because it's not giving away the winners.
No.
We go in knowing who the nominees are. Oh, well.
Mm.
But yeah.
For future.
So yeah, and it was good to see Shackle win something, because I think it's a fabulous film. Of course, you were involved with it, helped make the eyes for the weird little gremlin puppets.
Gremlin puppets. Really?
I'm sure that's how Ainsley describes them.
Gremlin owl things.
She, her, and it.
Lanky Furbies.
No, wait.
Yeah.
She, him, and it.
Well, there was a great presentation you all did at MAF, where they brought the puppets, and you'd have to scroll down a little bit, but I think there's
and
some really nice...
And you have to hold them like the babies.
Yeah, cradle the puppets.
They're ginormous, aren't they?
Mm.
Yeah. You'd have to scroll down a bit, but I think there are some nice pictures from that event on the Squiggly Insta. But yeah, Shackle's really... Yeah, it's really quite something. Where are we? Best sound?
No, best international series went to The Tiny Chef Show and Factory Create. Then the best use of sound was Magic Light Pictures, The Smeds and the Smooze.
There you go. Well done, Magic Light Pictures. I think Martin Warren has talked to the folks behind The Smeds and the Smooze. So you can check that out as well if you want to learn more.
You've got all these bases covered. Just get yourself on Squiggly and, you know, click on the search bar and write in whatever you like and see what's there.
When will they learn, Stephen?
I have no idea, Benjamin. But they'll learn soon. So, yeah, another presence won Best Factual, which, yeah, that won at MAF a few years ago as well for commercial. So the social good category went to Change the Ending, which has been all over social media recently. There's been lots of clips of that shown all over social media, or at least on my social media, so maybe my algorithm knows I'm a big animation nerd. And the two of the newer BAA categories, it says here, the Cutting Edge Award, Challenging the Status Quo, went to Emma Calder for Beware of Trains. And the wild card was Two Gracious Uncles Smooched to the Beat by John Dunleavy. Yeah, Cutting Edge seemed an interesting category because there were three very different films in competition for that one.
Yeah, the one that The Line did, I thought would have been more of a kind of shoo-in because a lot of people this past year, well, the past 6 months or so, have been talking about that, like people I've been working with. And that's kind of rare, actually. Like, I find that oftentimes when you work in animation, the last thing they want to talk about is animation.
Yeah.
You know, like they're not necessarily the biggest animation fans in the animation workplace, unless they're like, you know, the very young ones who still kind of have that, like, you know, connection to the stuff that they watched as youngins. But no, as far as like the sort of scuttlebutt around it, there was a lot of enthusiasm for that one. It was called The Line Experiments, wasn't it? Beware of Trains, we showed at Manchester in the Squiggly screening. Yeah, good fun.
We'll hear from Emma soon.
Best undergraduate film went to AUB, a film called Cortex by Sena Miyazaki. Best postgraduate film, NFTS film, Wolf of Custer by Tanya Scott, who Squiggly listeners will be familiar with if they followed the Visible and Visuals podcast series. She did an amazing job putting those together, and she's been working very hard in the industry for a very, very long time, and it's very nice to see her doing well.
Chubb will be talking to her as part of the round table later as well.
Excellent. That's a great film. Another film we screened at the MAF Squiggly screening.
This Squiggly screening is the place to be.
Exactly. We're the, you know, we're a, what's the opposite of a jinx? We're a good jinx.
Yeah,
good.
We're a lucky charm.
Lucky charm.
There you go, lucky charm. The Lamb Award then. So this is for people who are just young professionals getting started off in animation. It's a great way to kind of to celebrate people as they kind of make their first kind of step into industry. And the winner of 2024 was Malachi James, who works at Blue Zoo. So there you go. Well done, Malachi. And as you said, the two awards of the night decided by members of the public. The winners were Netflix Dead End Paranormal Park, which is a great series based on the comic by Hamish Steele, and Shackle, as we said, directed by Ainsley Henderson. And that was when they got the kids to vote for the award, because the awards are structured in a way, there's always certain things happen. You can always guarantee a hilarious video montage of kids selecting their favorite film, which it gets the biggest chuckles of the night.
That was so good. We need to, do you remember that one kid who was like, I have notes. I was like, we need to hire that kid for Squiggly because she is sassy. Yeah. She was like, I didn't like how this was and I wouldn't have done it this way. I was like, yeah, 9.
Well, her notes are just as valid.
They are.
It was interesting seeing people that young talking about Dead End Paranormal Park.
Yeah.
Because I've seen quite a lot of reaction to it as a show and a lot of enthusiasm for it. But it's been way more of a kind of young adult up to uni crowd who have kind of like, I mean, I guess because they, you know, they've got the social medias So I'm not really going to see what 9-year-olds are saying about it outside of, you know, a British Animation Award montage. But it was interesting to sort of see the elements of it that they found particularly engaging. And yeah, by all accounts, a very good show. And yeah, all too short-lived, which can be said about so many shows. Well, there you go.
Yeah.
Congratulations to the team, at any rate.
There's a few changes this year, obviously, to the awards themselves. A change in host. We got Henning Venn, who was brilliant, I must say. I saw him years ago at Edinburgh, doing the Edinburgh Fringe. And since then, you'll have noticed him on, like, Mop the Week and everything. You know, basically any TV panel show there is. And he did a great job for the British Animation Awards to have a German hosting it, which... was nice. It shows the kind of how international we are, which is very nice. But yeah, great stuff. Great stuff there. And then there was the he really kind of brought the show around, didn't he? Because there was the in memoriam bit of the show where Brolly Man, who's, you know, long associated with the British Animation Awards, played a beautiful original piece of music on the guitar, which, you know, gave us a moment to kind of reflect on everybody who we'd lost in, over the last few years, and to see their names pop up on as part of the show. And, you know, it was a reflection, and it was sad, and it did really bring everybody down. And I think fair to say Henning Venn picked us all straight back up, like just went into, like, you could see it, a switch go on in his head and go, right, comedy mode, just like, let's just get everybody back on board, let's get everybody laughing again.
Well, I think it was mainly pointing out the placement of the in memoriam section within the program of events.
Yeah.
And then, like, the expectation of trying to bring people out of that funk. So, okay, more awards, I guess.
Dog and Rabbit did a good job as well with the intro.
That was awesome.
That was so good.
Mm.
That was, yeah, very, very funny stuff. It really kind of brought the house down as well. Like, yeah. People were really, yeah, up for that.
And what an amazing thing to commission, because that would have been a tremendous amount of work for such a, you know, one day event kind of thing. Yeah. Like, yeah. Hopefully it will see the light of day.
I saw them posted online.
Yeah.
Which part but of the series. It wouldn't
make sense in any other context.
it's got a series online as well. So that character, but like really short, little YouTube-y bits of the character.
Minisodes,
I suppose you'd call it whatever you like.
Vignettes,
stuff for your eyes that is not long. Little episodes of that, you know, mad professor character trying to create. I think it's like a child-friendly car seat or something like that. It's just really exactly the same temper and exactly the same humor. Just brilliant, absolutely brilliant. But nice to see him introduce the BAAs as well. But yeah, that was hilarious. So that is online as well, as you say, Laura. And usually every year there's everybody, they get the people to come to the BAAs and make artwork and then hand it over to everybody else. And it's this beautiful kind of exchange of artists creating work and sharing and everything else. But this year it was everybody got the same. You know, we love you all equally. Everybody's getting the same this year. There's nobody's getting a more expensive present. It's like, it's nice and even.
It was a nice award, but I do miss, because that was always my favourite thing about the bars, is that everyone got like something really, really unique.
Sure, yeah.
And also just sit, because I remember the year before when they'd made them, and like, I think Will Anderson had made one and he'd made like a puzzle.
Mm.
With, like, I can't remember what it was, but it was, like, basically just a white puzzle with, like, one sheep in it or something.
Yeah.
And, but he'd, like, really taken it, like the spectacle of it to another level. Like, he got his shrink wrapped and he put, like, multiple, like, reduction sale tickets on it.
Yeah.
It was very clever. So, I like that unique element of it. But, the award for this year was also very pretty.
Yeah.
I did feel bad for the people who won multiple awards, because now they just have three of the same poster in a line.
Yeah, that aspect of it is, you know, I guess they can divvy it amongst the crew.
Yeah. You can have one at home, one in the office, and one in the bathroom.
Yeah.
One in the car on your way to work. Yeah.
Yeah.
If you go on to Squiggly, there's an interview with Derek Hayes, who did the artwork that was the main prize, just sort of talking about how and why that sort of came about. There's also an interview with Brolly Man as well, Q&A thing. As part of our general British Animation Awards coverage. Derek Hayes, I'm sure, is a familiar name to a lot of people. I think right now he's based at Falmouth, but he's been around forever and wrote one of my favorite animation books, or co-wrote with Chris Webster, Animation Performance. It's one of the books that I found really, really... I found a lot of Chris Webster's books very sort of helpful as far as just being instructionally quite clear. But that one in particular is, yeah, it's really sort of easy to kind of get your teeth into and get your head around.
But then, so yeah, an evening of celebration, an evening of awards, an evening of booze and drinks and networking. And then the bombshell was dropped after three editions. Both Helen Brunston and Kieran Argo decided they'd had enough. And there was a shock announcement at the end of the night that that was their final BAAs. And they're going to move on to obviously continue being as they are, major figures in the world of animation. But who will take the baton and continue with the BAAs?
You could feel the collective hot potato in the room of being like, not it.
Yeah.
Yeah, but we were asked, Jen and I were asked, and we were like, off. Like, that was our response. Oh, you guys, who are you going to do it? Get out of it. And that was in before the book.
Maybe it can just be a day event at Mass. That's right, Londoners, come up to the north. Join us.
Come up to the north on one of our many cancelled trains. But no, it was... the BAAs is always such a spectacular job, and it's always an event which, you know, brings everybody together and is such an essential part of the calendar. And I, you know, it is great that it's on every 2 years, because it always feels like it's every year. I don't know how best to describe it, but you always feel re-energized, and it's great to look back on all the amazing work that's taken place and be able to celebrate those films that have, you know, come and gone, but get a last hurrah with the last awards being handed out and things like that. So it's always wonderful. And I think we'll all agree that both Helen and Kieran have done an amazing job, because before them, it was Jane Pilling who ran the awards for 20 so years. And it was very much, it was definitely in the mould of Jane. You knew exactly what you were going to have. Again, you're going to have an amazing event. It was going to be an amazing night, an amazing celebration of animation, being as Jane is a champion of animation. So Helen and Kieran had an incredibly difficult job to keep the flame alive, you know, keep it going. And they've managed to do that. And they've also managed to put their own unique spin on it as well, as much as they can with something so established. So yeah, I think it's worth saying what a fantastic job they've done, and very big shoes to fill for whoever's taking over the British Animation Awards.
Well, to be continued.
Yeah.
Now we got them hooked, shall we bring on the round table?
Yeah. Now you've had your list. Here's another one. We were joined by the cream of the crop from the British Animation Awards.
Superb. Let's hear what they have to say.
Okay, I'm Camilla Deakin. I'm co-owner and co-founder of Lupus Films, and we were one of the producers of Kent's Kiss Kingdom, which won the bar for Best Feature Film, directed by Neil Boyle and Kirk Hendry, Best Original Music for the composer Stuart Hancock, and the Writers Award for our screenwriter Frank Cottrell Boyce, which was lovely. And then the other award we won was for our Christmas special, hand-drawn half-hour called Mog's Christmas, directed by the lovely Robin Shaw, which we jointly won with another project, a beautiful film called A Bear Called Wojciech.
Oh, yeah. Thanks very much, Camilla. Yeah, I'm Ian Gardner. I work in Edinburgh. I've got a small studio called Animation Garden. And I teamed up with the Illuminated Film Company and Filmograph in Poland to be able to basically get the resources together to make A Bear Named Wojciech. And as Camilla was saying, it was a joint winner in Best Long Form, which, it has thrilled me to bits. To be standing next to Camilla and Robin and everybody, it meant a great deal. It was such a... I'm a bit of a Doctor Who geek, and in my head it was like the bi-generation that we just saw with Shuti Gatwa and David Tennant. I kind of feel that Robin and I have done a kind of weird Time Lordy split on it, but it was lovely. It was so nice.
So my name is Tanya J. Scott, and I am the director of The Wolf of Custer, which won Best Postgraduate Film.
I'm Emma Calder, and I'm the director of Beware of Trains, which was made by my company Pearly Oyster, which is in Brixton.
And you won the Cutting Edge Award.
Oh yeah, I won the Cutting Edge Award. Very kind.
I'm Juan P. Arroyo, directed the Great British Bake Off trailer that won Best Animation in a commercial. And I directed this awesome project at The Line Animation. That is a studio in London. It was so much fun to see all the lovely animation at the awards and to share the event with you guys. It has been an honor.
Fantastic. I suppose that leads on to my first question, really, is the how are we all feeling? This is the day after the awards. I'm feeling a little worse for wear. However, I'm still feeling the love of British animation that kind of kept me going throughout the day and through the hangover. How are we all feeling after last night's celebrations? Because it really is a special night, the British Animation Awards, isn't it?
I think likewise, I'm feeling very worse for wear. I can't remember the last time I drank so much. But it was a really great night. It was like, I've worked in animation for about 13 years now, and there were so many people that I used to work with, colleagues and friends. It feels really great to celebrate like British animation with your peers and really, a load of people who are really passionate about doing the same thing you do, and we all enjoy each other's work, and just to talk about what everyone's working on and, what these past 2 years has brought out in the industry. It was really good fun.
I totally agree. I thought it was a lovely event. I think one of the main things about animation is that it's a collaborative medium. We always work with lots of different people, and we've been running Lupus Films for 22 years now. And, so many people in the audience we've either worked with or we've admired them for many years, or, we it just feels like it's a lovely, collaborative, supportive environment. And one of the things that Ruth and I were really struck with, what's really struck by when we were watching a lot of the films, was there's loads of 2D and hand-drawn and traditional craft methods being used in a lot of the films that were winning and were nominated. And it just fills me with a lot of pride and pleasure that we've got such great, talented animation talent in the UK.
Well, I didn't have a hangover. I just think maybe I've got very hardened, actually, over the years to drinking wine. But I felt fine, so I got up bright and early, went to the gym, went swimming, and then I've just been kind of at it all day. Because, you don't get the money to make films. Well, I don't. The kind of films I make, I don't get the money to make them that frequently. So in between, I'm teaching, part-time the odd day. But what I was struck by was how many of people in the room had been my students. So, I just felt like, oh my God, just like, there's like 20 or 30% of the people at bars, I feel like I've talked at some point. But what is so great is that thing that a lot of people seem to think that, particularly with the level of budgets that we often get in the UK, that you can just make it in your bedroom. It's that kind of has been for many years that kind of philosophy. If it's an independent animation, we don't really need to give it proper money. So I was the lucky recipient of the BFI Short Film Fund, and that meant that for the first time in many years, I was able to have a small team working for me. And that was just so, for me, the award wasn't for me, it was for them, and just getting all those young people up onto the stage who'd worked so hard and we'd had such a laugh making the film, through lockdown. That was just great. So That's how I feel today. Very proud that they could all just be so happy about it, really. And I'm happy too, but, you know, I've just got to carry on and try and get the money for the next film. So my mind is just on the next, always on the next project, really.
Fantastic. And the next BAAs, hopefully.
Yes, I mean, you know, that's what we've got to look is like, who's going to take that on? And I think Helen's got plenty of ideas about it. And so hopefully that's going to be, you know, possible.
Yeah. Mm. Ian?
Yeah, I just want to pick up on what Emma was saying. I mean, I think the struggle to get any of the work that we're doing funded is difficult at every level. It's not just the kind of independent films. I mean, I couldn't speak for Lupus, but I'm sure getting a budget together for something like Kinski's Kingdom is not easy, and is not guaranteed to roll around. So we're all, you know, in the predicament of trying to get work funded. I think the nice thing, I mean, yeah, like everyone else, it's been a stinking hangover. But I think the nice thing for myself, and again, I didn't think I would come away with this award. I was really looking forward to seeing everyone. And I had plans, and I did. I was at the Natural History Museum today, and that's how I was trying to distract myself from the kind of anti-disappointment of Germany. I think that the nice thing for me today in terms of actually having got the award was just firing off quite a few emails that were kind of like, do you remember that conversation we were having like 3 or 4 months ago? Could we pick it up again now? It's just, you know, so I think, again, addressing that issue of the struggle to get things funding, I think it's really helpful. It's really helpful to reopen doors and open other ones.
As somebody who's directed a commercial at the Wampay, are these kind of thoughts that cross your mind as well, in terms of, it's obviously a different budget structure, and do these thoughts cross your mind as well?
Yeah, it's a different situation. You guys are really brave because you are definitely working in that area where you have to find the money to produce something that isn't original work or is not related to a brand. In this case, of course, we have budgets that come from the brands that we are advertising. It's a completely, I wouldn't venture to say anything about it, because I haven't done what you guys have done, and it's really impressive what you guys do. It's an interesting thing. I think for the night, for me, I have been in previous years of the British Animation Awards, and for me it's always like meeting friends. Like I used to work on TV shows, and I work on Gumball for many years, and Gumball was always like nominated for animation or for writing. So I got the opportunity to go to assist to these celebrations every now and then, and every time was to meet these friends that I haven't seen in a long, long time. For me, actually, last night was more like, I really wasn't expecting any kind of, I definitely thought that we weren't going to win anything. And for me, it was like, okay, I really want to see how people react to the video, because once we work on these projects, that we have the feedback of our friends and we have the feedback of the client, of course, and our coworkers. But it's such a difficult thing to see a big audience reacting to an advert like this. And when people saw it and they were laughing and they were like enjoying it, for me, it was like, that was the award.
Amazing. And I think it goes to show the kind of a new ingenuity of a brief. I hasten to say that you did sound a little putting yourself down a little bit there, because you did direct a commercial, but the amount of creativity required in a commercial is absolutely stellar. It's not something that needs to be, you do need to put yourself down for. But the beauty of this roundtable, I would say, is that we have somebody who directed a commercial and somebody who has produced a feature film and everything in between. And we have this kind of this celebration of animation, which shows on all made in the UK as well. All British, which is marvelous.
I have to say, I'm sorry it sounded that way. I'm just like trying to I think it's I admire what you guys do. It's like, I have to say, and it's one of the things that I really like about The Line, and that's where I'm working with them, is that when we approach these projects, that, I mean, they're commercials after all, we try to achieve the same kind of creativity and freedom, creative freedom you guys have on your personal projects and on these short films and movies that you create. And this, The British Bake Off, was one of those. Once we got this project from Channel 4, there was like a really fluid communication between the client and us, and we were creating the thing with them, and they were open to all the suggestions, and it was like almost like creating our own little short film of some kind. And for me, it's really close to the thing that I usually do, because I work on Gumball, for example, had this like mix of live action with animation. And in this case, I got to direct live action for the first time. That is something I always wanted to do. It was terrifying, but I really enjoyed it, and I really want to do it again if I can. But yes, yeah, it was like, thank you also for saying that. I really appreciate it, Steve.
Sorry for telling you off.
Go ahead.
Amazing. And Emma, your film won a new category, Cutting Edge Award, for challenging the status quo. Tell us about the cutting edge qualification of the film.
Well, I suppose it wasn't just to do with the techniques. I suppose it's to do with the idea, really, that you can take, you know, ideas that perhaps aren't always openly discussed, like feelings that women have perhaps about their family life and fantasies, which are, you know, kept quiet. And I really wanted to bring those kind of anxieties, you know, into the world. And it was how to do that in a way that was both a little challenging, but also had some kind of structure as well that could let the audience into that. And the film was initially, you know, many years ago when I first wrote it, was a stream of consciousness idea. And I was always slightly dissatisfied with that. And I think, you know, maybe 5, 6, 7 years after I first wrote the idea, I had this idea that I wanted to have an interview with a woman. I didn't at that stage know it was going to be the woman talking to herself. But that leapt in, you know, another few years later. And then when the BFI fund opened, I thought, well, it's about time that I took the two parts of the idea and actually put them together to see if it had worked, if it would work. I already had a storyboard of the stream of consciousness bit, but then I actually sat down and wrote a full script, which put the stream of consciousness in this framing with the analyst in the therapy room and the woman talking to herself. So it started off as a series of questions which I just recorded myself initially, and then I just sort of, as I went through the stream of consciousness, I framed that. I think that was really useful. So it put these slightly dangerous ideas, you know, that the idea that the woman, you know, in a sense is feeling so sort of desperate in her sort of, you know, fantasies for the stranger she meets on the train that she ends up just having sex with a dead train driver. You know, that was just, that idea was in there right from the very beginning, when I thought of the idea in 1998, and I had been spending a lot of time traveling on trains because I was teaching down in Farnham one day a week. So I spent a lot of time kind of having time to look out the window and think. And you know, one day I had a very strange experience where I got on a train and I suddenly realized that actually I shouldn't have got on that train, because it wasn't stopping at any stations and it had no lights on. And I just started to walk through the whole train. And it was very, very frightening because, yeah, what's going on? And I think that was one of the things that triggered off the whole story. But anyway, I've kind of lost track of the question now. But yeah.
Fantastic. Well, it was about challenging the status quo, and I think having sex with a dead train driver certainly does that. So you've hit the nail on the head.
Yeah, and I actually thought, you know, it really ought to win that prize because that's the kind of, yeah, I kind of like to identify with that cutting edge part of making films, because it's, you know, I just don't want to make films that, you know, that everyone thinks that they like. You know, I know this film isn't liked by everybody. Some people are going to like it, some people are going to hate it. But I actually want people to feel something very distinct when they watch it. And I don't want them to just feel sort of complacent, really. So anyway,
and as you were talking about that darkened train carriage, it does bring the film to mind and moments of the film to mind as well. So yeah, very very expertly done. And Tanya, you were talking there about been working in the film industry or the animation industry for 13 years, and how long in the podcast industry? You've done Squiggly podcasts as well, I would say, but visible in visuals,
both for your job stage.
You can have it. I'm not doing a very good one. You've been involved in visible and visuals, and you know, a major part of advocacy work and stuff. But then you went back to do an MA at the National Film and Television School to produce your film, The Wolf of Custer. Can you tell us a little bit about the genesis and how it came to be?
Yeah. So basically, what happened was, another student dropped out of the NFTS and I had applied the previous year, and I managed to take up the place. So I went straight into the grad film. I didn't actually do the first year in completion, and I was working while I was studying as well, which I don't recommend anyone do if they go to the NFTS. And so basically it was like very much quickly like, have you got an idea, pitch an idea, get a team together. And that's like the really exciting part of going to the NFTS is working with editors and composers and all kinds of people. So I'd actually heard this story about this wolf on a This American Life podcast. So if you Google Custer Wolf, it comes up with a press release from the US Department of Agriculture from the 1920s. And this was actually a legendary wolf that had loads of stories being generated about it. So they thought it was like paranormal and like nobody could catch it. And they had this ridiculous bounty on its head and it had coyote bodyguards and it was smarter than everyone else. And it's just this insane press statement. You can't believe it's like an official US document. And unfortunately in the real story, I won't ruin the ending of the film, but basically the real story and the film don't have the same ending because it was a bit of a bummer. But it was just such a brilliant bit of source material that we felt like, you know, every time I pitched it to somebody at the school, they just responded to it in a really positive way. So it felt like that was the story to make, even though thematically and tonally it's very different from a lot of the other stuff I do, because I come from art direction and children's TV. It was obviously a much more sophisticated and complex story, and it was such a rich bit of source material. It was really hard to sort of uncover which bits to use and how to adapt it and how to make it concise and not like a 30-minute film and only like reduce it down to like 8. So the story basically revolves around this main character who isn't named in the film, but we call him H.B. Williams, and it's a hunter who comes to this town to hunt the legendary wolf. And he hears all these stories and he decides it's all rubbish, so he goes after the wolf. But as he explores the landscape and he keeps on trying to catch the wolf, he starts to believe what he's heard. He starts to believe that this wolf is a legendary creature. And the idea is that that part of his imagination manifests in the landscape around him, and through lighting and design and colour, his world becomes more vibrant, because this is the power of storytelling. It makes our world more powerful, more meaningful. So he finds this legendary wolf, and again, I won't spoil the ending, but that's kind of like, that was like the main purpose for me coming to the school after working in so much commercial television, was to explore the avenues of animation, which I knew I would probably never get an opportunity to do any other time, unless I'm very lucky and I work somewhere. And, you know, I love feature films. I'd love to make a feature film in the future. So you know, coming from a place where I love loads of French animation, loads of Eastern European animation, and folk art as well. And obviously I'm an illustrator, so just trying to incorporate all of that into this film, it was very, very difficult, but we were very happy with the results. And a big shout out to the editor, Tommaso, as well, because we spent so many hours in the edit suite and he always had the curtain shut. So it was like just like a time void. But we'd be sitting in there for ages, like through countless animatics and storyboards, just working this story out. And I think, yeah, it was lovely for the jury to recognize that story aspect of the film.
Yeah, and you mentioned the illustration within. Obviously, that's a major part of the film. In the last act, it's a nice part of it. As somebody who worked in industry and then went on to make a film at the NFTS, which is famed for its approach to film production, working with people on the production course, the writing course, the editing course, and everything else, just to create something that is as close as possible to professional short film experience. How did that feel?
I'm going to be really diplomatic now. You know, not everyone goes to film school to work on animation. For the most part, they go to film school to do live action, and that's totally fair. But it's a shame because, you know, we're here talking about British animation. And I think I was saying this to somebody yesterday, and I said I ranted about it a lot while I was at the school because, you know, during lockdown, we were the only people working. And, you know, really, I think, animation's like the purest form of filmmaking. Like everything's under our control and we can explore like every emotion, all these really complex subjects. So it's like you can literally do anything with it. So I'm always just a bit like, come on guys, like animation's the best. And like everyone's a bit like, yeah, like I've got this live action film to go make. And you're like, no, please, like animation is so good. And thankfully, like there were people on my team who were passionate about animation. And I think it's really great to see that changing. I don't think it's there yet. I think there's still people who kind of look at animation a certain way and think like it's for kids or whatever. But it's really lovely to see people who are now in their 20s coming through and seeing it for everything that it can be, like whether it's games, VR, you know, animated shorts, animated series. They're now starting to think of it more in this way. And I think that's what's potentially going to be really exciting in the coming years to see from the NFTS is then when you've got the full backing of your team, like what kind of stuff do they make? What's the output?
Absolutely. So I think it was 11 or 12 years ago, I took a trip to the Edinburgh International Film Festival. And you were talking about a film, about making a film, about your two ideas that you shared with me, Ian. One was about a pair of badgers. And the other was about this fascinating story about a bear named Wojtek. It's been a long road, hasn't it?
Yeah, it always is. I think I heard Emma saying earlier,
1998,
You know, and I'm aware that I've got kind of notions in my head that have been percolating, you know, since my 20s, but the bear... I knew of Wojciech through drawing at Edinburgh Zoo. You know, he's probably the most famous kind of resident, for want of a better word, at Edinburgh Zoo. And quite a symbolic one at that, because he kind of basically represents refugees, came over after the war with a lot of the Polish servicemen that were displaced by the Second World War. And it's one of these things that kind of like any idea, it's in your head and it kind of just trots along. And then Brexit happened and I suddenly realised what the story was about. In some ways, the storytelling is accessible and kind of family friendly. But personally, I kind of feel it's quite subversive as well, because I'm basically making a film about how Britain actually used to be quite nice to refugees. And, well, not entirely nice. I mean, there were problems after the war and before the war and since. I suddenly realised that the story wasn't actually about the bear. It was about the stinky mess that's Britain. That became the kind of motivation to get it made.
Mm.
So it really accelerated after Brexit.
It's a film I know that has resonated with the Polish community as well.
We've had great feedback.
And yeah, absolutely. We screened the film at Manchester Animation Festival, and we had Polish communities get in touch wanting to see the film, when they heard about it, it must be great to get that feedback from those communities to know that the film has done the story justice.
Yeah, it's nice. There's a lady who I was hoping to see today. She's in her late 80s. She's not in the best health at the minute, so I couldn't see her today. But she was a Polish refugee that came to the UK, had a very similar experience of her family being taken by the Russians to Siberia, being released into the Middle East, when Hitler kicked Stalin in the backside. And again, discovering Christina gave me the kind of the voice of the film. Having parked the bear for its symbolic value, it really became a lot about what Christina's life experience was. The only thing, and in my defense, it's a half-hour film, and there are some things that I think are too complex when you're trying to set up the story that you're telling. But the only thing that Christina's really complained about is that near the beginning of the film, we show the deportation of the characters as a family. And she was saying that it didn't happen. The men were separated from their wives and children, and they were all sent in different, and this is the Russians, I'm not talking about the Nazis here, this is what the Russians were up to. And that was the only thing, because that was something that had happened to her, that I think has annoyed her in the way I've told the film. But it's not the film really, one of the things I've quite enjoyed about the kind of presentation of the film, the kind of marketing of the film, is that we've kind of made it look like the war story. We've made it look like, oh, it's Wojciech the War Bear, and people have heard of it. But we actually get through all of that in about, I don't know, a third of the film. And then the rest of it is about them coming to Scotland and how they were treated and how they kind of, became part of our culture and contributed to our country and how we should be grateful for that. And not come out with the rhetoric of Suella Braverman, Priti Patel, and the rest of the government who are going to get kicked out this year, I hope.
Hear, hear. Brilliant. It wouldn't be an Ian Gardner answer without trying to take down the government. So thanks for that.
Yeah.
And that moves on to your co-winners as well. Obviously, Camilla with Robin winning for Mog's Christmas. Both beautifully rendered half-hour films taking the award. It felt right, didn't it? It was such a beautiful moment with you up on stage with Ian and Robin not quite knowing where to stand or what to do. It was a beautiful moment to sort of share the kind of animal film triumphs, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. And it was a real night for celebrating good storytelling, I thought. I think both of, and also the warmth of the films, A Mog's Christmas and A Bear Called Wojciech, because Mog's Christmas is based on a book by Judith Carr, and she's probably most famous for The Tiger Who Came to Tea, but also a book called When Hitler Stole Pink Rabbit. And of course she was a refugee, a Jewish refugee from escaping from Nazi Germany, who ended up in the UK and was adopted by Britain and loved Britain and loved British culture and traditions and married a Brit and brought her kids up in London. And she was an amazing woman. She lived to the age of 94. She always liked a nip of whiskey every day. That's what kept her young. And her books are just very warm and charming and funny. And I think Robin's done an amazing job with Mog's Christmas, bringing that humour out and always keeping it from the cat's eye view. And using his trademark moving camera animation, where the animation is not just the characters, it's actually the backgrounds as well. And a lot of that kind of fisheye lens effect that you get in Mog's Christmas, where, you know, Mog always causes chaos wherever she goes, not meaning to. And of course, everyone forgives her. But I think, you know, we've been through some tough times in the last few years, and I think it was a film that people really responded to, because I think those kind of Christmas specials are films for all the family, parents, grandparents, godparents, uncles, aunts, you know. And I think, again, in the story of Mog's Christmas, it's not just about the Thomas family and their pet cat, Mog. There's also an extended family, the jolly uncle and the two aunties, and you're not quite sure what their relationship is to the family, but that doesn't matter, because Christmas is a time where family means a bit more than just your blood relatives. And the song theme, the song is called As Long As I Belong, was written by the fantastic composer David Arnold, and the lyrics by Don Black, who is an absolute legend, you know, won the Oscar for Born Free and wrote the songs for The Italian Job, you know. So we all love Don. And we really wanted to think about, you know, it doesn't have to be about nuclear families, you know. There are lots of different types of families in Mog's Christmas. There's Mrs. Gaynor, who, you know, a single mom, and there's the man that runs the Christmas tree shop, who's just at home with his cat, and there's the chestnut seller in the street, and the neighbours, and, you know, actually it's more about community and about feeling that, you know, it's important to feel you belong wherever you are, wherever you've come from, and whoever you are. And that's, I think, the sort of underscore message of Mog's Christmas.
And obviously, we're talking about the kind of the British stories of or the adopted British stories, I suppose, if you want to put it that way. But talking about stories, the winner of Best Feature, Best Writers Award, and Best Original Music, obviously went to Kensuke's Kingdom, which was originally written by national treasure Michael Morpurgo as well. Much loved classic adapted into feature form, and to pick up loads of awards. My question, everyone's question, is when's it heading to cinemas? But before, I'm sure you can't answer that, but how did that feel, being up on stage, accepting so many awards for the film? Because it is a beautiful piece of work.
Thank you. Well, Emma was talking about when she came up with the idea for her film, and you were talking about meeting Ian many years ago, talking about his film. Our fellow producer, Sarah Radcliffe, optioned Kensuke's Kingdom in 2002. So, you know, it was a 22-year journey. And she originally conceived it as a live-action movie. And she brought Frank Cottrell Boyce on to write the screenplay. And they did quite a bit of work on how they were going to make it. And they came to the conclusion, probably not that surprisingly, that filming with live orangutans and a small boy on a deserted island would A, be very expensive, and B, potentially a little bit dangerous. So at that point, she pivoted to making an animated film, but she hadn't made an animated film before, and she needed to find people who had. And she'd actually seen a short film that was directed by Kirk Hendry, that had won lots of awards and had an ecological theme, and there's an ecological theme in our story in Kensuke's Kingdom. And she approached him, and he was then working at a commercials company with Neil Boyle. And Neil Boyle, for anyone who doesn't know him, is a kind of legend of British animation. You know, one of his first jobs out of college was working with Richard Williams on Who Framed Roger Rabbit. And he really did his apprenticeship with Richard Williams and was Richard Williams's kind of golden boy back in the day, and worked on many, many films, including the legendary The Thief and the Cobbler, and then went on to work on Space Jam and had his own studio, and is very well known amongst a certain generation of animators who worked on a lot of Disney and Warner Brothers movies. and he's got excellent, excellent 2D animation skills. So he'd worked for us at Lupusfilms on The Snowman and the Snow Dog, and our feature film that we made before Penske's Kingdom, which was called Ethel and Ernest. And it was actually while we were in production on Ethel and Ernest, Neil took us out for lunch and said, I'm attached to this movie. I want to make it in 2D hand-drawn. The producer's not experienced in animation. Would you consider coming on board? And when he told us which book it was based on, we got very excited because my kids had read the book at school and absolutely loved it. And the thing about Penske's Kingdom is obviously Michael Morpurgo is a master storyteller, so it has a fantastic story. And it's kind of classic storytelling for all the family. It's a thrilling adventure story in the mold of a kind of classic Steven Spielberg movie where, you know, there's danger and there's jeopardy and there's drama and there's threat, but there's also heart and love, and it's just very, very heartwarming. And one of the things that we loved about it was that it touched on some really important themes, a bit like Ian's film. You know, essentially at the heart of it, it's about a little boy who's British, who only speaks English, and an elderly man who's Japanese, who only speaks Japanese. And they're thrown into this difficult situation where they're stranded on a desert island. And somehow they have to work out how to get along, how to communicate and how to survive. And it doesn't go that well at the beginning, but eventually, you know, in the face of various adversities, they come together and there's a lovely kind of grandfatherly grandson bond that they form. And I think that's a metaphor, again, you know, for the fact that just because someone is from a different culture, speaks a different language or a different religion or a different color to you or a different age group to you, that doesn't mean, you know, that you should be at loggerheads. In fact, you know, you must come together and collaborate and cooperate. And I think that's weirdly even now more important than ever before, more important than even when we started the film, what with the kind of, you know, dreadful things happening on the world stage. So that was important to us, but also the ecological message, because the thing about Michael Morpurgo is all his stories, as well as having a very strong pacifist theme, they're also nearly always featuring animals in very important roles. And, you know, Michael's always, as you know, from War Horse and from, you know, his book Adolphus Tips and many other books, loves animals and feels passionately that we must live in harmony with nature. And I think that's what Kenski's Kingdom's all about as well, is it's all very well being human, but we've got to remember there are other inhabitants of this world and we've got to respect them and look after them. And that's what made it such a lovely film to work on. And then I think, thirdly, it was exactly what Tanya was saying, which is that animation is the most exciting film medium because you literally start with a blank piece of paper. You've got no sound, you've got no dial, you know, you've got nothing, and you can do anything with it. And so one of the first things Neil and Kirk wanted to do was to really strip out a lot of the dialogue that was in Frank's original script and simplify the story. So lose the whole kind of setup at the beginning, lose the whole kind of coda at the end, and just go bang, straight into the story. You're on the boat, they're a family, they're sailing around the world. We don't need to know where they came from, really. We don't need to see any of that. We're just in the story. And then suddenly, bang, you know, Michael's washed overboard and he's on this island. He doesn't know what he's going to do. He doesn't know how he's going to survive. And from that point onwards, there's hardly any dialogue at all. And so I'd say a good 2/3, if not more, of the film is minimal dialogue. And that's the beauty of animation, is that you don't need lots of talky heads to tell a story. And I think that's where also the incredible sound design and the incredible music that we got from our brilliant sound designer, Will Cohen, and our brilliant composer, Stuart Hancock, really helps, because it's always telling the story in a way that doesn't require people speaking to each other. And that's the essence of the story, is they can't talk to each other. Kenski and Michael can't talk to each other, but they go on this incredible emotional journey. And, you know, the bond that they form by the end of the film is very, very moving. And I have to say that I still cry at the ending of the movie. I've seen it many, many times. And it's always, you always feel a bit strange when you see your film in a cinema and you look around at everyone, you're thinking, well, I hope they're all crying. Quite often they are. they come over and they tell us how much they loved it, and they loved the fact that it made them cry.
That was recently in Anima, and it's an international effect. It's something that happens elsewhere, and I've told you in the past when I was in Anima that they were laughing at different parts that we laugh at in the UK. I think there's a little bit in Ethel and Ernest where they talk about Belgium on the radio, and the audience just cracked up, you know, because it was like nostalgic for them. But that's that wonderful thing about animation, is it tears down barriers as well, tears down borders, which is nice. I feel
it travels. It does. I just want to say that my favourite bit to watch of Ethel and Ernest, our previous feature film at animation festivals, which always gets a big laugh, is when Ethel receives a letter saying that Raymond has decided to leave the grammar school and go to art school. Yeah. And she's crying because it's such dreadful news. She wants to go to art school. And of course, they then have a conversation about he'll never get a job. There's no money in it. You know, and then Ernest says, and it's all drink and long hair and nude women. And of course
that's exactly what people thought, you know. That's what when I got into foundation, my dad didn't talk to me for like 9 months or something. You know, that was what people thought in those days.
That's what I thought. I was bitterly disappointed when I arrived on my first day at Barnsley College and there was none of that to be seen, you know.
Well, there's a joke here for me to say that's what the NFTS is like, but it's not.
But that's the thing, is that we, in the UK, we do have amazing creative industries, and, you know, that's why it's always really sad when, you know, the creative arts are not valued by the government, and, you know, art and music and drama and all those other important things for, you know, children to enjoy and, you know, and potentially get a very, you know, healthy and satisfying career from, and not taken particularly seriously. But I'm glad to say that last night, you know, we were surrounded by people who bucked the trend, defied the odds, defied their parents, and went and got a job in the creative industry. So well done, everyone.
Hear, hear. So that leads me on to my final question. I feel the more we've had this conversation together, that the films that we have here might be the perfect encapsulation of what is British. We have everything. We have animals. We all love animals. We have stories of immigration, facing adversity, adventure. We have stirring music. We have trains causing misery. We have baking. We have family. We have all these things that I think if you had to write down a list of what makes something British, you'd probably write them down. What do you think makes British animation? I'll start with you, Wanpei. What do you think makes British animation British, if that is indeed what it is?
Wow, what a question for somebody that is not from here.
Yeah.
You're here now.
I feel after winning a British Animation Award, I feel completely accepted in this community. I have to say there is something, because on the projects I work, I've been working here in England for, I think, 10 years now. I work for a long time on TV shows, and I think one of the things that I see that it's common to all the projects is that there is always an edge to them. I don't know if that's correct, but there is always a twist to them. Like even if it's a TV for kids, The Amazing World of Gumball, it's very famous for being a show for kids, but it has this crazy twist that works really well with adults. Like they capture the adults' imagination and they make them laugh and make their kids go like, "Hey, wait, why are you laughing?" Because the joke was not for the kids, was for the parents. And I think that's what happens with the Bake Off. I think we managed to get that into the project. I mean, the premise from for Creative and Channel 4 was already quite good, and it's like the ingredients are so excited that they will do anything to get there. And then we work with them and we get them these twists where they are almost like maybe I shouldn't say, but they're almost suicidal. Like they just like they are okay with like getting hurt on their way to this thing, to the point where actually that's the goal. They are going to be destroyed there because that's what they want. And that's what makes them happy. That's the final twist of the video. And it's such an edgy idea and also weird to see in a project like that, that is for a very famous show that is very heartwarming and is for families. And we felt as a team that it's something that it can only be done here. Like you wouldn't be able to do it anywhere else because there will be people say like some people are going to react really badly to this thing, and we were like confident enough and Channel 4 was like confident enough to let us go all the way and get these ingredients to die on the screen in a very funny way. It's not gruesome, but they die and people laugh and people enjoy it, so it's pretty good.
And they enjoy it, importantly, as well, I'm sure.
Yes, that's the main point, that keeps everything very safe in the end.
Emma, what makes British animation British?
Well, I think it's quite interesting, because I think it's like, we're a kind of, there's a melting point, isn't it? Because there's so many different people working that come to the UK. You know, people come to London or they come to the UK to work all over the UK. So you get people from all different countries and cultures coming together. So that's one thing, that the Britishness is this kind of like, I think there's a freedom, but then there's also the essence. If you think about design education, when I was at college, you know, I mean, I did graphic design, but the whole ethos behind the way of thinking was, it wasn't to be toe the line and be like everybody else. It was to be as different as possible. I suppose that's quite individualistic, I suppose, in a way. But it was all to do with pushing your creativity to the furthest limits. And I think there's also the sense of humour thing as well. I think that does come into it. But, you know, lots of other countries have good sense of humour as well. But I can't quite put my finger on it. So it is that thing that there feels like there's a creative freedom, and it is that way in which people have been taught. So in other art colleges, perhaps, you know, I haven't been to France, but the kind of way they train is more industrial generally. And I think that you don't see that same industrial process going through art schools and design colleges here. And I think that's a big difference. So, yeah, I think that would be one of my things that makes our stuff, you know, maybe have an edge too, in general.
Tanya, is there anything that you think gives British animation the edge?
Yeah, I agree with what Wanbei and Emma both said. I think for me, you know, I've been doing a little bit of teaching this year and also like coming in through the education system again. I think like because of the system of education in this country and paying for education and also, you know, the kind of jobs we're looking to fill, I think we've got to be careful as an industry not to persuade too many universities to do, as Emma said, what France do and almost treat our students to come in and only think about being animators or whatever. I think like obviously that's important and there's a place for people who only want to do those things, but I think historically we've really nurtured like original creative content, and it would be a shame if we didn't nurture that in upcoming generations where we have a more diverse, you know, set of people joining the workforce who are more representative of what modern Britain looks like today. Because, you know, it's no secret that I've talked about this a lot, but, you know, me being mixed, it's, you know, my vision of Britain as a Londoner from a mixed background is very different from somebody else. So I think like it's just maintaining those values and those things that we want to represent through our work. But I do definitely think as well, it's like obviously things like our sense of humour, like I'm Hey Dougie, like even that 40-second clip yesterday that he plays brought me so much joy, and like Peppa Pig, I'm a huge fan of, and I think it's that really cheeky wit that we can implement in all our little projects, which I think is true for the Great British Bake Off, you know, commercial as well. Like, you watch it and it just brings you such a little nugget of joy in such a short segment of time. And that's what I think British animation does the best.
Ian, you used to curate the McLaren Award at the Edinburgh International Film Festival, yeah, which is a celebration of British animation. So what do you think makes British animation British?
I could just only follow on from what everyone's been saying. I think we have an education process that encourages a lot of individuality and diversity. I'm aware, you know, having started doing bigger projects, I'm aware that industry, there's a lot of pressure on art colleges to be more kind of cookie cut, you know, that people want graduates to come out on certain softwares and all the rest of it. But I think that that's quite dangerous for Britain. I think the critical thinking that students get, I know a lot of them do come out and complain that they didn't learn anything, but they may not have realised how much they've been learning to think and been learning to be critically engaged with the world. And I fundamentally just think we need to focus on why we're animating and not necessarily how we're animating. So I think that's something that will help us in Britain. And I'm not saying that we don't need to teach people, you know, certain skills, but yeah, I do think that kind of looking at things from different angles is really important. And another wee thing, to harken back to Camilla, because I got to know Neil Boyle, who directed Kinski's Kingdom, when I was young, and I went to Dick Williams' studio. And I think we're really lucky to have had Dick Williams in the UK. I don't know where else, he was Canadian, he could have gone anywhere else. But he just elevated the skill base at his studio, and everybody that came out of there elevated the skill base at their studios. And I don't think there's anyone working in animation who hasn't been affected by the ripples of Dick Williams. You may not like his style, and you may not consider yourself a kind of Dick Williams or that kind of hyper-controlled style of animation, but I don't think any of us haven't been under the influence of the impact that he made in this country.
Amazing. As well, obviously, the UK being a story of immigration, it's not just Dick Williams. There are many others, John Hallis, for instance, and many others. So,
yeah, Dunbar.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
Plenty.
I think what's interesting is that when British animators talk about Dick Williams being really inspiring, you hear the same sort of story from Irish animators about Don Bluth.
Mm.
And then, of course, we had Jimmy Murakami, who spent half his time in the UK and then went to Ireland. And I'd just like to put in a word for John Coates at this point.
Yes.
Because John Coates wasn't an animator, he was a producer. But he kind of spotted an opportunity in the late 1950s, which was that ITV was launched as the third channel, a commercial channel that had advertising. And so, you know, and I think Harris and Batchelor were doing the same thing. And, you know, suddenly there was this whole British animation industry that sprung up around the commercials industry and bred a lot of amazing talent that then went on to work on things like Yellow Submarine and The Snowman and Animal Farm and all those incredible kind of 2D hand-drawn films. And I think that really started a feeling of, we can do this. Yeah. You know, we can do this. We don't have to wait for America to send us their cartoons. We can do our own type of cartoons, because America would never have made The Snowman. And they certainly wouldn't have made Father Christmas, because there's a scene in it where Father Christmas is sitting on the toilet. And Raymond Briggs had a very funny letter in his downstairs loo from an appalled American mother who'd taken the Father Christmas film out of the library and was disgusted to find it showed Father Christmas in an act of personal hygiene, which is absolutely shocking. And I do think toilet humour is one thing that us Brits really do love. But I'd echo what everyone else said about the sense of humour, but I just also do want to say that we did some stats on the crews that work on our long form films, and I would say about 30% of them were
not British. I mean, they weren't born here, and didn't consider themselves British. So, you know, all the really good British productions, commercials, films, specials, series have got very multicultural crews, very international crews. But I do think one of the things that we have here is, as well as the sense of humour, is a rebelliousness. You know, we're the country that invented punk and, you know, fashion. You know, we had Vivian Westwood and I mean, I know those are rather out of date examples, but I do think that, you know, we do love to be the bad boys, if you like, and rebellious and a bit cheeky and a bit naughty and our sort of sarcastic, self-deprecating humour. And I think maybe that plays into our animation a bit as well.
Amazing. Well, thank you all very much for joining us for this BAA Awards roundtable. Thank you for talking so candidly about your films and for sharing your thoughts and your insights on British animation as well. The British Animation Awards are obviously back in 2 years' time, we hope. I'm sure we all want to congratulate Helen and Kieran on a job well done as they leave their role as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah,
it's
thank
a good job, and they did it brilliant. They did it brilliantly.
Absolutely. Yeah, it was really good fun, wasn't it? It was great.
Yeah, and the addition of the In Memoriam thing was brilliant. I hope that gets maintained. It's nice.
Absolutely. Lovely to see some of those faces up on the screen and just remember what a huge contribution they've made to the industry.
Yeah.
Fabulous. I won't do any inappropriate jokes now that we brought the tone down, as Henning Venn did after the In Memoriam mention, but I just want to thank you all again for being a part of this Squiggly podcast, and congratulations on your awards, and see you soon.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for you.
So thank you for everyone for joining the exclusive little Squiggly British Animation Awards roundtable there.
We don't have to do it for another 2 years, then. We finished it.
Phew.
Yeah.
And unclench. Well, yes, in the meantime, lots of other animation fun times ahead. We'll be at the Cardiff Animation Festival, if anyone is thinking of checking that out. There's going to be the Squiggly Filmmaker Q&A brunch sessions, which are always a good time. I'm just really looking forward to just being back over there.
Welsh cakes,
that's the main draw.
All the different flavours of Welsh cake.
Yes. It's an exciting time ahead.
And then some cartoons.
Who could want more?
Mentioned before that the Bristol Animation Meetups are still happening, and you might want to come along to the next event. I have a feeling that they're not going away anytime soon, and may even become more frequent. We've evolved into our own sort of entity, in the sense that we have our own Instagram. So if you want to follow us at Bristol_Animation_Meetup, that'll be probably the best port of call for learning about when the next event is on the horizon, until we can think of other things to add. But yeah, it's a growing thing. And like I said, so far, only one person got COVID, at least, that, you know, and then decided to get in touch with me about it. So relatively safe event for your health. No. People are digging it, so we're happy to help you all out.
Oh, fantastic.
It's my savior complex kicking in. Speaking of helping out the wider animation community, if you really want to enrich your lives, why don't you go ahead and give Squiggly a follow? We're on Instagram at Squiggly Animation, facebook.com/Squiggly Magazine. I guess we're also still on X at Squiggly. The website, of course, is squiggly.com for all the news, reviews, interviews, podcasts, extra bits and bonus featurey things. It's a damn good website, and you're going to be glad you visited, I guarantee it. Or all your money back. go keep yourself busy doing that. I've been Ben Mitchell.
I've been Steve Henderson.
And I'm still Laura Beth.
Fabulous stuff. We're all still who we are. Until next time, everyone. Happy animating.